Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Tong He, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Astrid Muller-Olsen about her new book, Sensing the Xenophone, Urban Memoryscapes in Contemporary Fiction, published by Cambria Press in 2022. Dr. Muller-Olsen is an international research fellow with London University, University of Stavanger, and University of Oxford. Her position is founded by the Swedish Research Council. Dr. Muller-Olsen holds an MA in Comparative Literature and a PhD in Chinese Studies. Her research has been published in Modern Chinese Literature and Culture, SFRA Review, Canadian Review of Comparative Literature, Prism, Theory and Modern Chinese Literature, and International Journal of Heritage Studies. She hosts the podcast Xenophone on Realities and the literary blog Xiaoshuo. Astrid, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself and how did you come to write the book?
Yeah, right. So like you mentioned, I have an MA in comparative literature. And during my studies there, I was just felt a bit limited by the sources that we were looking at. It was mostly European stuff, a bit North American as well. But I wanted to do something more than that. And then I found out that I could actually study Chinese at that time without having any kind of previous knowledge. I could study Chinese at university and learn a whole new language and open a whole new world. So I was like, that was amazing for me, a complete breakthrough into another world. So I did my MA and studied Chinese on the side, and then slowly just transitioned into reading more and more Chinese and Sinophone sources, fiction, and discovered, yeah, a whole new world. And my kind of mission since then has always been to recombine those subjects like area studies and comparative literature, to combine that knowledge of the language and familiarity with cultures with the kind of theoretical and creative frameworks of comparative literature. So that's also what I'm trying to do with this, my very first book. And I first had the idea for it when I was reading Zhu Qianxin's Gudu, or The Old Capital, a short novel or a novella that that she wrote. And in that, it was just so powerful, her way of describing how Taipei in Taiwan was changing, like from one day to the next. She would walk through a neighborhood and buildings would be gone, other buildings would be there. And her way of describing those changes and what they did to her protagonist, what they did to her protagonist's sense of self, her sense of time and memory and reality, basically, when the place that you live in changes so rapidly and so fundamentally, what does it do to your identity? And since reading that, I thought that would be something worth exploring further and see how perhaps other authors in other cities experienced that kind of rapid development. And that time, I thought that maybe there were other East Asian or Chinese-speaking cities that I could look at that had similar rapid transformations, because, of course, many cities experience tremendous transformations, but what stood out here was kind of the short time and the fundamental changes to those cityscapes. And that's where my ideas for the book began to form. And then I just read on from there.
Wow, that's a fascinating journey, actually. And indeed, learning a language opens us a whole new world. So I guess probably we can shift to the thematic elements of your book. Could you elaborate on the concept of literary sensory studies and its relation to urban memoryscapes in contemporary fiction?
Absolutely. So after my initial ideas of how changing cityscapes affect our memories, I thought, okay, on the one hand, I have the cityscape, right? Even though it's transforming, it's a very material structure. It's out there. It's physical. You engage with it physically. And then the memories are so elusive. They're completely inside your head. It's like the complete opposite. And I was really challenged, how do I make a connection between those two things? How do I make it into a coherent whole in my analysis? And that's when I thought, well, the senses are kind of what it seems obvious now, but for me it was like a wow moment. I thought, yeah, the senses is how we perceive the material world, and it's also what ignites memories, thoughts, projections, imagination. So that is a link between the material and the elusive or the cognitive. So after thinking that, I discovered that there was already something called sensory studies, of course. Mostly within anthropology and sociology, people looking at how different cultures, different time periods have different views of the senses, that the senses are not just there, but they're culturally constructed. They're constructed through language and how we expect to perceive them. And I found that extremely inspiring. And I discovered that in the study of literature, there are many studies of course, sensory engagement and the senses. But I felt that one of the kind of most essential or fundamental aspects of sensory studies was the challenge to the conventional pentagonal sensorium. And I wanted to take that part into literary studies so that in the book, when we look at the senses in relation to memory, it's clear that no one sense really works in isolation. They all work together. So for instance, in the eye chapter in my book, I mainly look at what cannot be seen, but what can be imagined or remembered and other kind of visual modes. And I also wanted to add some more non-conventional senses, like, for instance, a sense of time. So we can sense that time has passed in a way that involves the whole body and manifests through fatigue or hunger. Then we know that time has passed. We sense that time has passed. And so that is a very real kind of coming together of a lot of different senses, also sensing changes in light or change in temperature, and exploring how these other senses could work. And of course, fiction is a very fruitful ground to look at these things because you can experiment a lot in fiction. You can see what would this kind of sensation feel like. So in the specific case of a sense of time in the book, I look at how the circularity of daily rhythms. So a lot of urban fiction, daily kind of concerns are very important. Everyday life is very important. So how do those daily circular returning rhythms combine with the linear perspective of time in a changing city, where things do not come back, which actually changes very fundamentally from one thing to another, and also the linear time, of course, of aging, the aging human body as well. So those were kind of the things I asked my novels and short stories, how to combine different senses of time.
Thank you for that insightful explanation. It's interesting how sensory experiences shape our perceptions of cities in literature. Speaking of specific cities, you selected works set in Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Taipei. Could you explain what you refer to as the three city problem in your second chapter?
Yeah, so with a bit of a tongue-in-cheek, I borrowed, of course, the title, The Three City Problem, from Liu Cixin's famous sci-fi novel, The Three-Body Problem.
Right.
But apart from loving sci-fi and really engaging with sci-fi more and more, and speculative fiction in general is just fantastic, and a lot of awesome stuff coming out of Sinophone authors from all over the world. Yeah. And anyway, so Liu Cixin himself also borrowed the idea of a three-body problem from physics and mathematics. And there it is, the problem of if you have two objects of similar mass that engage with one another, it's quite simple to calculate how those bodies will move in relation to one another. But if you add a third body of almost the same mass, this equation becomes so much more complicated, because as soon as one body interacts with the other, it affects the movement of that one, and then that affects the third one, and it kind of, you can imagine, it's difficult to explain, but you can imagine that it becomes exponentially more complicated. And that kind of complexity really inspired me. I thought, rather than looking at two cities, comparing two cities, I would compare three. It also had to do with kind of like the research history of urban literary studies, specifically in a Chinese context, where we have several studies more comparing, you know, Jingpai, Haipai, if you've heard of it.
Exactly.
The Beijing fiction versus Shanghai fiction. What are the very different elements of those? Mm. So there is a tradition of these kind of binary comparisons, or it could be like East-West. You choose a Chinese city, Shanghai, and compare it to Paris or Berlin or something. Mm. And those kind of binary comparisons often create a lot of dichotomies, and they tend, there's a risk of overlooking internal heterogeneity within those cities themselves. So I thought that comparing three cities might just confuse matters and provide new perspectives and kind of help me not falling into too many of those traps of creating dichotomies. And then when it came to choosing the cities, I deliberately chose cities that were kind of on the edge of various cultural constellations. So also cities that have colonial or semi-colonial histories, so that they already have this interrogation of their own cultural identity, or the idea that cultural identity is perhaps fundamentally hybrid or fundamentally something that is under negotiation. They're also plurilingual and have many languages spoken. So all these things just added to this messiness that I find very fruitful in my work and pursue.
Yeah, indeed. I guess that really says, by inviting the third party here, like, we bring really lots of changes and dialogues. And that really sets the stage for a nuanced exploration of these distinct urban environments. So I guess naturally, my next question is on the structure of your book, which is quite unique with its three parts, skeleton, corpus, excretions. And how and why did you decide on this particular organization?
Yeah, thank you. First, I think it is just based on the idea of an introduction, the main analysis, and the conclusion. But I thought it would be nice to phrase it in a more corporeal language that is similar to what I use in my framework. But having done that, it actually helped me a lot to rethink a tendency towards a more formulaic approach to academic writing, where you tend to think, okay, so I need this part and I need this part, and this is the schema of how you write an academic paper or an academic book.
Right.
But it made me think, so why do I actually need a section called methodology, or why do I need a section called something else? Well, a methodology or a set of theories is actually like a skeleton on which you construct the analysis around it, so that the methodology doesn't just become something that has to be there because people expect it, but it's actually something there that's there to help you build a foundation for what's going to come later on. And it also helps you make sure that when you construct those analyses, you can go off in various different directions, but there will always be a kind of connection between the toe of the analysis and the fingertip of the analysis, because they're in the same skeleton. They have the same connected bone structure, if you will. So it helped me think about connectivity. And the excretions was a fun way to say outcome. Again, more messy, like a conclusion. It sounds so tidy. It sounds like you've actually solved your research problem. And that must just come up with a lot of answers to our research problem, and perhaps also many more questions. And excretions, just helped me think about my outcome in a way that was less a finished package coming out of an analytical machine and more like organic, a mixed juice of my very personal engagement with a lot of previous research and a lot of literary material.
Exactly. I really like the phrases and your explanations here. And also, I guess, probably that also gives that coheres with the corporeal reality you mentioned throughout your book. And also by reading the chapter's name or the part's name, I figure it's more kind of like the organic whole, less as a kind of a book, but more kind of like a personal experiences, your individual journeys through those cities. So I feel that's really kind of like an explanation. And really,
I'm so glad you say that, because that's really, you know, I've really didn't want to make it, I made it a bit difficult for the reader by not having sections on each author or each city, like mixing it everything up.
Right.
And my idea with that was exactly that they can actually tell us a lot about each other, the different cities. So if I had just one section of each, I would mess that whole messy engagement, the whole organic engagement. So I'm glad that, that's coming through.
Exactly. So I guess probably now I want to go into the details of the corpus part, where you delve into the bodily forms of memory in the city, which brings me to chapters 4 and 6 that I found particularly compelling. Starting with chapter 4, could you give us an example that illustrates the relationship between the human inhabitants and the botanical environment of the city?
Absolutely. I'm glad you asked this, because this is actually my current research interest. So I'm happy to talk about it. Yeah. I found that in this, working with this book, both plants and scents and smells, they seem to generate nostalgia in the narratives that I looked at. Both plants and smells become a kind of anecdote for specific chunks of space-time. An example of that is, for instance, the cherry trees in Taipei, which were planted by the Japanese during their colonization of Taiwan. They become a specific marker of that period in Taipei history, and they also become a marker of cultural identity. And in Shanghai, you have the same with the plane trees in the city, become a very strong marker of old Shanghai. Mm. And that link between the city and its emblematic plant is not just geographical, but also a testament to a specific history that the city has gone through. And it's not only like a landmark, it's actually a living landmark, because it's growing with the city, right? So it's very powerful and potent in that way. And smells in the same way can also be used as markers as specific cultural identities, and can be used to patrol cultural identities, like they smell but we're neutral, or you know, they cut down the trees that we have a connection with and they grow those plants and we grow those plants. So it can also be used to patrol identities. Like, for instance, Zhu Chenxin, again, she traces individual family histories through the plants that people have in their backyard, so that she can say that because people in Taipei have come from many different places around the world or have been to many places, you can like kind of read a family history from the plants that they choose to grow in their garden. Other authors I look at, like Dong Kaichung from Hong Kong, he also plays with these strong emotional bonds, but he used them to kind of criticize two simplistic notions of cultural belonging, or people who try to create a sense of community rather than nourish the communities that are already there. So when he writes about Hong Kong, for instance, or the plants that symbolize Hong Kong, he writes that the fig trees, which are called Wuhuaguo in Chinese, no flower fruit, so a tree that in its name has no flowers, they were cut down even though they were growing there, and then they were kind of replaced with the current symbol of Hong Kong, the bauhinia, which he writes is actually a barren plant. So it has many, many beautiful flowers, but it doesn't actually produce fruit. Right. So perhaps that's not a very promising symbol to choose for his city. So he uses those kind of plants, goes into the plant symbolism and say, what does it mean when we choose a plant to symbolize our city, and what does it mean to connect to the plants that are actually growing there?
I think there are also in your discussion, are you suggesting that by choosing specific or talking about the connotations of specific planet used as a kind of the mark or the symbol of the city, do we give an identity for that city instead of the individuals, or treating the city as a whole? There's a kind of a communal identity. It's just my thoughts there.
Yeah, that's true. It's also a good point. It's always, if you think of a city having only one emblematic plant, then that becomes a kind of monoculture, and monocultures are not the most fruitful, perhaps. So, yeah, you're right.
So I guess probably in your discussion about through this plants observing these olfactory mapping of the different cities, did you notice any similarities and differences there among these three particular cities you talked about in the chapter?
I think that the similarities are that these trees actually, when or trees or plants, but trees are particularly potent because they live for quite a long time, so that they connect to a longer history. I think that they reveal in all of the city, but particularly in the Shanghai and Taipei novels, a very ambivalent relationship to the colonial or semi-colonial history. Because on the one hand, the people want to enter a post-colonial period and rule themselves, but on the other hand, there is a nostalgia for earlier colonial periods, you could say, and a feeling that has become a very strong part of their current identity, perhaps setting them apart from other cultural centers that are trying to draw them in. So I'm thinking in Taipei, the Japanese colonial period is both seen as something to be criticized, but also as something to be nostalgic about, when Taiwanese citizens currently feel themselves perhaps taken in by or overwhelmed by other bigger cultures like China or the United States trying to influence them. And then it becomes a store of something that sets them apart as well. So it reveals a very complex relationship to colonial and semi-colonial history, and the same in Shanghai. This link to the plane trees, because they are also very common in a lot of other cities, and they're actually, in English, they're called the London plane trees. So they have a connection to this very European environment that a lot of Shanghai writers love to fantasize about and be nostalgic about.
I guess we talked about this. You have this subtitle in your chapter as post-colonial planets, and we talked about it. And also, I'm interested in kind of the flowers. You use a lot of examples from the text to suggest the flower smells of love. Can you kind of elaborate on that as well?
I must admit that it seems a bit far away at the moment. But I know that one of the books from Shanghai is about a man who, because there is this tendency to, throughout history, to equate or to have used flowers as symbols of specifically female beauty. And that's that could be very problematic in its own right, because it kind of isolates femininity to be, or being a woman to being something ornamental or something nice to look at, and not having a lot of agency. And one of the stories kind of engages a little bit with that, in that it is set in Shanghai, and specifically in Shanghai, there's this idea of women as being beautiful flowers. But the author actually finds that his current relationship with a very strong woman is become simple symbolized by this green plant that doesn't really have any flowers and doesn't really they think any moment now it's gonna die. I mean, that's how you look at it. So that's a very interesting take on this whole association between flowers as tokens of love, flowers as symbols of female beauty, flowers as symbol of erotic or romantic intent, then taking out the flowers and just looking at the green plant and saying, perhaps this is a more sustainable relationship.
Right, I guess. Yeah. I guess and also I really like the way you link that flowers and also the smells of it and or the odor of it, like especially the kind of from that fresh flowers that and that book, you have this kind of analogy between, you know, flower and how done that example there, you know, like, so I think, that's a fascinating chapter. I think probably we can go to the next chapter. In chapter 6, you discuss the skin as a boundary. Can you describe the concentric boundaries that you explore in this chapter as well?
Absolutely. So the idea of the concentric circle is it's actually a way of ordering society dating back to when Confucianism was popularized in China, and the idea that in terms of your own individual body, you have your heart mind at the center of the body. It kind of orders all the other inner organs, and the heart mind is set in the center of the body, not in the head or anywhere. But and in the same way in society, you should start by setting your own household in order, and then order kind of spreads to the village and to the state. So order begins at the center. And we can see kind of remnants of this idea of concentric circles of orderliness in current discussions of cultural Chinese-ness, where mainland China is positioned as some kind of anchor or center. And even sometimes this is phrased very positively, like the margins can bring a lot to the discussion, but it's still quite problematic to see a culture as something that has an essential center in this way. But fortunately, there's been some really interesting and cool studies by scholars who question this concentric logic and position new centers or even engage in attempt centerless comparisons. And I was really inspired by these, like Ryan Bernard. He uses the South China Sea as a kind of empty center, or a center that is connectivity rather than the land masses themselves. And Clara Iwasaki does the same with the Pacific, I think. So some really interesting stuff going on there. So, but in my book, I still found the idea of the human body as a center for a kind of sense of self that has rings, larger and larger rings around it into the city, as something that could be interesting to look at. And in my case, I use it to explore the protagonist's very personal relationship to their city. So their sense of self almost seem like a lot of layers that extend from personal identity to the skin, to the clothes they wear, to their neighborhood, to their city. And in here, I'm inspired by Friedensreich Hundertwasser, the architect who had this idea of individual, of identity as layers in this way. And that's something, a more like organic way of exploring these, of exploring these concentric circles. So looking at, how these protagonists engage with their cities in larger and larger chunks. But I also look at some of the more problematic effects of this kind of centering, very strong centering, like potential xenophobia, when you have such a strong relationship to the city and when you position yourself at the center of these concentric circles, it is very, can be very hemmed in and not so open to interaction or changes from the outside.
Right, exactly. I guess, and also after mentioning that, you also talked about this kind of issue, the idea of centering, because like for the certain characters, they put, like, especially the protagonists of the novel, they kind of put their home as the center, and then, you know, walk all the way back to the urban spaces. So I wonder whether you can kind of like elaborate a little bit on this kind of a boundary setting and drawing.
Yeah. So can I answer something in your next question as well? Because I think it has to do with this idea of spatial identity. For the protagonist, their personal identity seems just to be so determined by the city they live in that for some of them, like Ding Liying's protagonist and her story, it seems unlikely that she could even survive anywhere else. I mean, she is so caught up in her daily rhythms in Shanghai and the way, and even her image of herself, if she was to live somewhere else, she would have to be another person because she is so strongly identifies with herself as a Shanghai person. So that can be a downside of those concentric circles, that you simply, if you move too far away from the center, you evaporate, or you cannot exist a function.
Right, exactly. And I remembered you also cited another Chinese writer called Chen Ran in her writing The Private Life. But then you use her as kind of like a counterexample to suggest this kind of a resistance or like a challenge to this public and private space. So I guess probably can you talk a little bit more about that part as a context?
Thank you for bringing that up. That's one of my favorite novels. Chen Ran's The Private Life. It's amazing. And I think it's because in some scholarship until quite recently, there's been a tendency to look at women writers as a particular breed of writers and to find out things that were specifically feminine in their writing. And that has been then the private sphere for the women and the public sphere were kind of more for the men. And of course, this complete bollocks and culturally made up. But what's interesting with Chen Ran's story is that she kind of breaks with those gendered expectations. And she writes a story that is so much about privacy, but it's so very political and so very engaged with community and society. But completely centered in private emotions and experiences. And I think if we look at it closer, probably a lot of women writers and writers of any gender do this in interesting ways.
Probably, I guess this may be kind of like a follow-up question on this spatial identity we just talked about. So are you suggesting like for female writers centering on this kind of a center or between these female writers and male writers, do they have like kind of different trajectories of projecting their spatial identity or like this process, the very different paths to form their spatial identity?
So the term spatial identity helps me to visualize how a person's urban identity kind of becomes a diagram of the body's daily routes through the city and how those routes are then filled with the melodies of the languages they hear, the scents that they smell, the breezes and that they feel and the tremors they feel from the underground and all the memories and fantasies and imaginations that those sensations then provoke. That's what I mean by spatial identity.
I guess your insights into how urban environments shape and are shaped by their inhabitants are incredibly enlightening. As we start to wrap up, I'd like to know about any future projects or research that you are currently working on.
Thank you very much. Yeah. So at the moment, like you mentioned, I've been working on a research project for the Swedish Research Council about plants in fiction. And I just had funding from the Carlsberg Foundation in Denmark to continue this work and to write a book about plants in contemporary fiction. And in that, I look at how plants and botanical characters in so many different ways help us to think beyond the human bias. I want to look at, for instance, how plants work as co-inhabitants of planet Earth, of course, that help us provide perspectives beyond the Anthropocene on how to live our lives. But I also look at plant-human chimeras, so hybrids in speculative fictions, of how human beings might need to change and become more post-human in order to live more sustainably. And speculative fiction is great to experiment with that kind of thing. A new interest for me is translation. So I recently started translating into Danish, which is my parent tongue. And so I'm also going to look into what interspecies translation between plants and people can bring to the discussion of translation in general and vice versa. So, for instance, I have an article coming out here in April in a new journal called Plant Perspectives. And there I look at plants and translation. I compare three works in Chinese, Spanish, and English that all write about plants. So translation from plant to human, but also between different languages. And again, I pursue messiness as a way of more complex understanding of the individual components in the individual languages and how language affects how we think about anything, including languages themselves. So I think that plants in this analysis, apart from providing a radically alternative perspective on the human role in the ecosystem, they can also provide new perspectives on things like gender and sexuality, on language and communication, and help highlight the process of translation as something that is co-creative.
That's a really organic take on the action of translation. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading that article. It sounds like you're having some exciting work ahead. I want to thank you for taking the time to discuss your book and your research with us today. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I'm sure our listeners did too. Take care, and we look forward to hearing more about your future endeavors.
Thank you so much. Thank you for reading my book and for posing all these wonderful questions. I really appreciate it.